This is Audible.
Audible Originals presents Bewilderness Part 2, What Rough Beast? Written by Jonathan Mayberry. Performed by Shayna Small.
Part 1. The Hunter and the Hunted. Sicarii necesse est, occurrendum discrimini. If we must fall, we should boldly meet the danger. Tacitus. Chapter 1. The Pierce Tower, 58th floor. It stood in front of her, alien and impossible. Abby lay there, smeared with the blood of her friends and co-workers, shocked to immobility, staring in absolute horror at the creature who had stepped out of another world, out of another earth, armored and deadly and inhuman, with a pack of beasts resembling some nightmare version of hunting hounds. The alien, this hunter, glared at her, speaking her name, telling her that she, Abby, was a monster, was some hated and destructive monster. Mother of none, destroyer of worlds, murderer of infinity, goddess of death. The pack of beasts moved all around the hunter, hissing and snarling, tearing at the floor with razor-sharp claws and bearing terrifying fangs. Beyond the alien hunter, there were other things, monstrosities, crawling and slithering toward the threshold. A landscape of disjointed puzzle pieces seemed to make up that world, or worlds, for it was clear to Abby that the parallel worlds she had been trying to access had somehow become fused. Many of those other Earths were now one broken Earth. She saw several moons hanging in the sky. She saw burning cities. But there were also forests that writhed as if the trees themselves were barnacled tentacles reaching up from torn soil. Creatures flew through the air, warped versions of pterosaurs, but ill-made, with teeth and reptilian skin that glistened wetly. And just on the other side of the threshold, something like a centipede trundled toward this world, its legs red as blood, and each segment of its undulating body covered in dark green spikes. It paused at the edge of the threshold, antenna waving with increasing awareness and agitation, and then it came through, huge, 6 feet long with snapping mandibles like a bullet ant. The clack of them was loud as gunfire in the still room. Some vile liquid, mucus or venom, dripped from its mouth and hissed on the concrete floor. The hunter followed her gaze, and Abby saw the armored warrior stiffen as if she was also surprised at the sight of the giant insect. As the centipede scuttled toward her, the hunter lashed out with the toe of a heavy boot, knocking the thing backward. The centipede made a feline hissing sound and turned to look for easier prey. Its multifaceted eyes fixed on Abby, and those mandibles snapped and drooled. Abby screamed. For a moment, that's all she could do. Lie there and scream. The hounds all looked at her. Not at anyone else, at her. And then suddenly Abby was moving. Before she was consciously aware that she even could, she rolled over onto her hands and knees, pushed off from the bloody pool in which she lay, skidded in the gore as she fought for purchase, and then launched herself up, moving. "Run!" she screamed, trying to break the paralysis that seemed to glue everyone in place. "Get out of here!" She grabbed Rosa, jerked her away from the console, and shoved her violently toward the stairwell entrance. Others, a handful of the technicians, seemed to come awake at the sound of Abby's voice. The spell broken, they cried out in horror and scattered. Most of them ran away from the hunter and her pack, hugging the walls as they tried to reach the door to the elevators or the fire stairs. A few merely ducked down behind the gateway machine, hoping to hide. Dr. Sloan backed stiffly away until she thumped the exit door. And on the floor, Mike Castro was getting up, pulling Benjamin with him, shoving the doctor behind and shielding him. Castro had his Glock in his hand, and he brought it up. "Everyone out!" he roared, even though most of them were already in motion. The hunter turned to look at him, at his gun, With a deft turn of her wrist, her club suddenly expanded as inner sections snapped outward and clicked into place, transforming the weapon into a spear. "Do you stand with this murderer of worlds?" growled the hunter. "Do you stand with the mother of none?" Castro's eyes were wide and jumpy with terror, but his training controlled his actions. His fingers slipped into the trigger guard, curled around the curved metal, and squeezed. The gun bucked, but the shot was true, and it hit the hunter's center mass. The heavy hollow point slug traveled at a lethal 1,250 feet per second and hit with 450 foot-pounds of deadly force. The shot staggered the hunter, half-turning her. But that was all. The creature spun around and hissed something in a language that seemed to be all clicks and growls, and immediately, two of the hounds rushed at Castro, one going low, the other leaping into the air. Castro shoved Benjamin out of the way and opened up on the beasts from point-blank range. Abby heard the terrible shrieks, animal and human, as they fell out of sight behind part of the gateway. Benjamin stared at the guard for a heartbeat, then, instead of doing a thing to help him, whirled and ran for the door. Jacqueline Sloan was ahead of him, and Benjamin shoved her to clear the way. A few technicians followed, but the door was slammed shut in the face of the rest. Abby pushed Rosa into the fire tower and yelled for the others to follow. Some did, but at least half a dozen were trapped in indecision, not knowing whether to follow her into the stairwell or follow Benjamin to the elevators. In that moment of hesitation, the pack tore them down. The centipede reared up on half of its hind legs and lunged at Tony Sims, an electrical engineer. The middle-aged tech was a half step too slow in following Benjamin, and the creature's awful mandibles snapped shut around her thigh. There was an explosion of red, and then Tony was falling, arms flailing, eyes rolling high and white. Steam, or perhaps smoke, rose from the awful wound, and it looked as if the area around the bite had been melted away. Flesh ran like wax to reveal gleaming bone. Everything, all of this, happened so quickly, a few seconds of time. The hunter began striding across the chamber floor, spear raised to strike, alien eyes focused on Abby. "Mother of none," she bellowed. "Out!" cried Abby as she shoved the last of the techs into the stairwell. Then she went through too, pulling the heavy steel door shut with a chunk. "Help me hold it," she yelled. And Rosa stopped four steps down, turned, and ran back. Two others joined her while the rest thundered down the steps. They threw their weight against the door, forcing it closed until the lock clicked. A huge impact made the whole door jutter in its frame, but their combined weight held it closed. "What is that thing?" demanded Rosa.
I don't know," stammered Abby.
"It knew your name."
"I know."
Both of the exit doors on this level were designed to open from inside the chamber, but because of the danger and uncertainty of the project, and not really ever knowing what might come through, there was a security failsafe. Beside each door was a big red lockdown button. Abby flipped up the plexiglass cover and struck the button with the heel of her hand. Immediately, six thick, 10-inch reinforced steel bars shot out of the frame, locking the door in place. There was another massive impact, and the wall in which the door was set shook. Tiny cracks appeared, belching out brick dust.
"It's not going to hold," breathed Rosa.
"It'll hold long enough," said Abby.
"We need to get downstairs and reset the system. We need to turn off all power to the threshold."
Rosa looked past her and down into the stairwell. It seemed to coil around forever into darkness. Another blow shook them all.
"Go," ordered Abby. "All of you, go now."
There was a fire alarm on the wall, set next to a glass box in which a heavy canvas-covered fire hose was looped. And next to that was a second, shallower box in which a red-bladed fire axe was held with aluminum clips. Abby closed her eyes and turned her face away as she slammed her elbow against the glass of the second case. Then she took the axe, jerking it free. It was much heavier than she expected, but its solidity felt good. She hefted the axe and backed away from the door as a fourth blow struck it, and a fifth. Despite the cracks in the wall, the security door held. Then she turned and, along with the others, ran for her life. Chapter 2. The Pierce Tower, the climb. David Bailey hung from ropes, his thrashing body stressing the placement of the lost aero pitons he'd fitted into the thin gaps between the concrete framing around the shatterproof windows. Even so, the repeated impacts had strained their hold on the wall of the Pierce Tower. His body rocked back and forth, slack as a corpse on a gallows gibbet. Blood ran in slow lines down his face. He licked it from his lips, hot and salty. It smelled like copper and tasted like iron. And there was too much of it. His thoughts were confused, muddied, knocked askew, and for a long series of broken seconds, he could not remember where he was or why he was here. He fought to reclaim his clarity. This wasn't some recreational climb, not the conquest of another mountain. This wasn't K2 in Pakistan or El Capitan in Yosemite. This was her building. Why was he climbing it? Why had he come here at all? The more he fought for understanding, the more ferociously the pain battered him. Had he fallen? Was it a rock slide or an avalanche? No, you idiot, he scolded himself. This is Abby's building. Abby, he spoke her name aloud, feeling the contours of the two syllables, feeling the strength that was attached to them. They were as certain a tether as the kermantle that held him, and hearing her name in his own voice did something, conjured some alchemy, lifted some inner veil. Abby, he said again more firmly this time as he blinked to clear his eyes. I'm coming, Abby. Those words, I'm coming, Abby. Coming to do what? He raised one hand to try to sponge away the blood from the lenses of his goggles, but thumped his face painfully, and that took another second or two to make sense of. He was holding a gun, his automatic. A Sig Sauer 226 that was a relic from his days as a Tier 1 special operator before he became a fitness coach. But this was not Iraq or Afghanistan. This was New York City, and he was hanging from ropes on the side of Abby's building. Why? He raised his other hand and thumped away the blood. It was fully dark, and the city, his city, was burning. He had double vision because he saw two moons in the sky. Strange, though they were at different levels of elevation. They were different sizes. One was Luna, the moon he knew so well, the moon. But the other was different, not the product of head trauma. It was smaller, less round, less dusty, rockier. What the fuck? He croaked. And that's when he heard it. It. The scream, and that awful sound opened every half-closed door in his head, and it all came flooding back, the pulse, the bizarre and impossible changes to the city, the raging fires and the bird. The scream came again, louder, closer, full of raw hunger. David braced a heel against the window and used the leverage to turn toward the sound. And there it was, a huge shape, bigger than any bird, twice the size of a condor, its hideous body covered in glossy and mottled reptilian scales, like a flying alligator. And like that predator, this one had a mouth full of white teeth, rows of spikes that dripped with spit and David's blood. It came out of a long climbing circle and dove right toward him, fast as a hunting hawk, taloned feet reaching, mouth opening for another bite, coming in for the kill, screaming as it came. David screamed too, as he took his gun in both hands, raised it, and fired. 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 Chapter 3. The Pierce Tower, 58th floor. The hunter watched them scatter. The sheep, the servants of the evil one. One of them lay dead. The hunter looked at him with only a flicker of regret for his death and the deaths of others, and for the deaths still to come. Some things, however cruel they seemed, were necessary. This was a war, and the dead man was aligned with the enemy, with the mother of none. Sometimes a statement had to be made. She would tear down the walls of heaven and drown the mother of none in the blood of angels, if that's what it would take. Everyone who worked in this building was expendable if it meant accomplishing her mission. They would all die anyway if she failed, in both worlds, in all worlds. So if their deaths could help her succeed, then perhaps the survivors of this world would make saints of them. The hunter could feel death pulling her, too. It was like a vortex, constantly trying to devour her. If gravity could be weaponized by fate, then this is what it would feel like. She even felt herself moving, sliding slowly across the floor. Not toward the threshold, not specifically. Toward what it meant. Toward madness. Toward another failure in a line of failures stretching back through countless worlds. Toward death. The room swam as if the floor was on gimbals and things were fuzzy. Even the blade of her spear was hazy and indistinct. The lack of focus turned her stomach into a churning soup of boiled slush. The hunter quickly opened a panel concealed by the intricate designs on her right gauntlet. Even that took effort. It was always different. In each new world, in each new performance of this drama, there was that lag, that pull. And each time she had to adjust the stability of her suit. Otherwise, she would have simply taken the Mother of Night and dragged her through the threshold. Dragged her back to hell. But now Abby Corman was gone. There would have to be a hunt. Her hounds circled and whined, eager for the chase. The hunter did not know why the pull didn't affect them, or why it didn't affect anything else that came through, like the centipede. They did not seem to feel the pull at all. But she always did. She set her tactical computer to analyze the amount of drag and adjust the armor's stabilizers. The process took several minutes, during which the hunter stood fast, holding on to the edge of a control console bolted to the floor. The Mother of None was gone. The man who, in most worlds, was known as Dr. Benjamin Arnold, was gone. Others left, too, going through the exit to the elevators. That was fine. They were incidental. Suddenly she tensed as the realignment protocols fired within the suit. The first time it had happened, she thought she was dying. It felt like it. The forces outside and inside the suit tore through her, and it felt like she was being pulled apart, molecule by molecule. With all the various kinds of pain the hunter had felt since beginning her search for the Mother of None, nothing had ever hurt as much. She'd passed out and been dragged nearly into the vortex, blood vessels ruptured. Nerve bundles seemed to catch fire, and the fires of hell seemed to ignite under the surface of her skin. That was many years ago. Now, she stood and endured it, braced against it more forcefully than against the vortex pull. It hit her and punched through her and tried to rip her apart. Each time she swore that she was ready for it, used to it. And each time it tore a scream from her that boiled up from the bottom of her soul. As it did now. Slowly, the pain drove the hunter to her knees as her hounds circled and whined and then threw back their heads to howl like devils from the pit. Chapter 4. The Pierce Tower, 58th floor. Benjamin was the first through the doors to the hall where the elevators waited. He'd grabbed Sloane's hand to pull her with him, but the angle and the force of that pull were wrong, and as she turned to follow, she slammed her forehead into the frame. Sloane puddled down, her eyes rolling up high and white. Two lab techs, Chan and Broussard, were close behind, and they caught Sloane and dragged her roughly into the hall.
"Close the door," ordered Benjamin.
"There are still people back," began Chan, but Benjamin pushed past and swung the door shut, catching it only at the last minute before it could slam. He eased it shut the last few inches. There was a keypad beside the door, and he pressed his thumb against the sensor. It flashed green and then red, and the locks clicked audibly. Then he turned and grunted when he saw Chan and Broussard looking down the hall in the direction of the fire stairs. Broussard said, "What in the hell?" No one answered. They could all see what it was. It was simply that none of them could explain it. The door to the fire stairs had been torn from its hinges and lay twisted on the floor, stretching from the wall to the gateway chamber, and then into the open doorway was the trunk of a tree. Leaves and branches sprouted from it. The trunk was so massive that it filled that end of the hall and all of the doorway. However, what was weirder still was that trunk was bowed inward on both sides as if it had grown there, adjusting to the confines of the steel doorframe the way a tree might grow up around a lamppost or bridge piling, and the tree looked centuries old.
"Impossible," breathed Chan.
"I don't," said Broussard, but never finished the sentence. He merely stopped and shook his head. Sloane groaned softly, but her eyes were still closed. They laid her gently on her back, and Broussard, a biologist, quickly checked her over. There was a vicious red bruise blooming on her forehead and similar bruises on both knees. After hitting the frame, she dropped heavily onto her knees before the two techs picked her up. Now she hovered on the smoky edge of consciousness. Broussard bent to talk to her, though, telling her everything was okay, that things were fine, that help was on its way. His voice lacked conviction, and his eyes kept straying to the tree blocking one of their two possible exits. Dr. Arnold Benjamin kept punching the elevator key, but the doors refused to open. He yelled at it, screamed at it, and stabbed the button in a frenzy of fear.
"Where's the damn elevator?" he snarled. "The lights are on, so where's the friggin' car?"
Chan kept checking the door to the gateway chamber, as if reassuring himself over and over again that it was locked and that the security bolts were in place. His hand reached up and touched the bolts repeatedly, moving in a frenzied clockwise pattern. Benjamin stopped for a moment, panting like a dog, his finger joints flaring with pain from having missed the button and hit the metal plate too hard too many times. He sucked a finger as he turned to look at the others. Sloane was groaning and trying to move, but looked more asleep than awake. Broussard's words were a tossed salad of meaningless platitudes. Of course, things were not all right. Of course, they were in trouble. Why lie to the woman now? After all, it was her fault, wasn't it? And as for Chan, he looked like he'd gone totally over the edge. The man had OCD issues, which were useful for a detail-oriented lab tech, but now? "He's losing it," thought Benjamin. "They're all losing it. Why am I the only one who's keeping his shit together?" Then he went back to stabbing the elevator button and yelling for the car to arrive. Chapter 5. The Pierce Tower, 57th floor. They ran down the stairwell to the next landing, and then Abby stopped abruptly. "Wait," she said, as the others milled around in agitation and tried to squeeze past her. Abby shoved them back.
"Damn it, wait! Listen!"
They all stopped, and the fire tower was suddenly silent.
"Began
Rosa. Then she frowned and said, "The alarm stopped."
"Is it over?"
asked one of the techs, a plump 30-something named Connie. Her voice was infused with hope. Abby turned to look up the stairs, and the others followed her line of sight. They could see the fire door. It was still closed.
"Maybe it went back through the threshold," said another tech.
a rake thin woman named Jiwoo, who wore stylish jeans with artistically shredded knees and a coral blouse. Abby said nothing. She took a few careful steps back up, then flinched as something struck the door to the gateway chamber. The sound had the compact efficiency and density of a blow from a clenched fist delivered with one hell of a lot of power. There was a pause, and then several even more powerful blows. Connie yelped and ran halfway down the next flight of stairs. "Is it gonna hold?" asked one of the techs, a young graduate student named Riley. He was round-faced and red-haired, and his blue eyes were huge with fear. "It'll hold," said Abby, but she could hear the lie in her own voice. Jiwoo looked over the railing past Connie. "Some of the lights are off down there, see? On a few of the floors and all the way down, too." They all looked. Connie crept back up to join the others.
"What does that mean?"
"I don't know," admitted Abby. "Mike Castro and I turned the power back on. All of the floors were lit just a few minutes ago."
"What does that mean, though?"
persisted Connie. Jiwoo brushed strands of dark hair from her face. Her face was calm, but her fingers shook badly.
"Is there something down there?"
"No, no, there can't be," insisted Abby. "I mean, other members of the staff, whoever was kept here as support for the test firing. I mean, for the damn true firing."
"Dr. Benjamin sent the non-essential staff home," said Burke, a burly biochemist with thinning hair and blue jeans that were ironed to razor creases. "Should only be the techs, the ones up with us and the others down in the backup room. Maybe a few others scattered around in security."
Jiwoo was shaking her head as he spoke.
"Why would any of them turn off the landing lights down there? This is the emergency exit. It doesn't make sense."
Burke turned sharply to Abby.
"What if something else came through the threshold?"
"Can't happen," Abby said firmly.
"Are you sure?" asked Riley.
He was a grad student in environmental engineering who always wore a pop culture t-shirt under his lab coat. Today's was a retro Doctor Who and the Daleks one, but the shirt and the coat were spattered with blood that was still far from dried.
"Of course I'm sure," she insisted. "The threshold is the only way into..."
And her words were cut off by a sound that coiled upward through the stairwell. It was a strange noise, not a growl. Nothing as normal as that. It was a heavy, slithery sound, as if two huge pieces of rough, wet leather were being rubbed together slowly. They stared down. The sound seemed to come from about halfway down, and as they looked, another set of lights winked out. The sound came again, rising from the darkness.
"Oh, shit," breathed Rosa.
Jiwoo glanced quickly at Abby.
"What's happening? What's down there?"
"I don't know," insisted Abby.
"What do you mean you don't know?"
asked Connie, her face going a dark red. She stabbed a finger toward Abby, jabbing the air an inch from Abby's face every few words.
"That thing upstairs, that alien thing, knew your name. How could something that came from another world know your name?"
"I don't know." "Hey," said Rosa, coming to Abby's defense. She batted Connie's finger aside. "Why don't you dial it down, girl? And I mean right now. Abby wasn't even here when the gateway was fired. How the hell would she know what's going on?"
"No, no, no," insisted Jiwoo. "Connie's right, Abby. Why did it call you the destroyer of worlds? Why did it call you mother of none? What is it?"
"For Christ's sake, Jiwoo," Abby snarled. "I don't fucking know." They flinched back from her. Rosa put a hand on Abby's shoulder, a wordless show of support, but also a message to calm down. They all stood and listened. The pounding upstairs was slow but constant, heavy, measured blows, as if the hunter believed she could break through the thick steel of the security door. Below the scraping sound, it stopped, or perhaps moved away from the stairway too far to be heard.
"Is there something down there?" asked Burke. "If so, how did it get downstairs?"
Abby shook her head. She glanced at the fire axe and wished it was a shotgun or something. She wished David were here. He used to be a soldier. He was the tough one, the fighter. Maybe he'd know what to do.
The backup generators were on a completely different circuit from everything else, explained Abby. Those generators are heavily shielded to prevent any kind of damage from a gateway accident. If we can shut off all the power in the building, it will close the threshold, and no more of those things will get through. Then we can restart the main building systems, lights, air conditioning, door locks, and landlines. We can get out of here and contact the authorities.
What about those things? Asked Burke.
We can reactivate the security cameras, locate whatever's coming through, and lock down any room they're in, Abby assured him. Don't forget, this building was designed to survive a nuclear blast. If we get to the control room, then we'll trap that alien and the other things in here until SWAT can come.
You saw what happened when Mike Castro shot the hunter thing, said Riley. It just shrugged it off.
So it has body armor, some kind of Kevlar, whatever, said Rosa. If we reset the system, we can tell SWAT that and they'll bring something better. Guns with armor-piercing bullets. They'll call in FBI hostage rescue and maybe the military. Whatever it takes, one way or another, the cops will shoot the ass off that alien bitch.
Rosa's right, said Abby. Our job is to shut down the threshold and keep this contained until help arrives. And to do that, we have to go down to the backup control room on 22.
Burke and the others gaped at her.
You're serious? You want us to go down there?
Yes, we have an active threshold and not a stable one, Abby said. You saw it. It's cycling through all those other Earths. It's, I don't even know how to say it, combining them, mashing them together. God only knows what it'll do to our world if it spreads.
Maybe it has, said Rosa,
her fingers touching the cross under her blouse. Everyone stared at her.
What's that supposed to mean?
Asked Connie, taking a fearful step backward.
Those pulses, whatever they were, said Rosa. They seemed to expand out straight through the walls, right? You all felt it. And what they did to the shutters? When it comes right down to it, we don't know what damage that may have caused. And the threshold is still active. Maybe it's kicking out more of those pulses.
All the more reason to get down there and reset the system. It's the only way.
Yeah, well, you can kiss my ass, Abby,
Burke said, backing away.
No way I'm going down there. Not after that whatever it was we heard.
No, it's okay, said Jiwoo. Whatever that thing is down there, it's closer to the ground floor, I think. We only need to get to 22.
Only? Snorted Burke, shaking his head. We're on 57. That's 35 flights down, and some of those floors in between are blacked out.
Abby moved to the top step, brandishing her axe.
What choice do we have? We have to stop this. We're part of how this happened, and we have an obligation to try to fix it.
Wait? Obligation? You can straight up fuck that shit, Burke fired back. I'm not on the policy level. I didn't have any part of this happening.
Jesus, Burke, sneered Rosa.
Try growing a pair. No, better yet, try cultivating some empathy. Abby's right. We have to stop this, because everyone else might already be dead. And if this spreads beyond this building, and we just hide in a closet and do nothing, then it's really on us.
Burke started to reply, but realized everyone was giving him harsh glares. Even Jiwoo and Riley. He muttered something under his breath and looked away to avoid their eyes, but flapped an arm in resignation.
Then let's go, said Abby. We're running out of time.
She took a steadying breath and placed a foot down onto the step, then another. When she was halfway down, she looked up to see that no one had followed. There was a moment of silence, and then the pounding on the fire door above them intensified. Suddenly, they were all scrambling downstairs.
Chapter 6. The Pierce Tower, 58th floor. The hunter climbed slowly back to her feet as her pack whined and pressed against her, needing reassurance that she was okay,
even though they had been through this with her many times, just as their parents and grandparents had. They always needed reassurance, and the hunter reached out a trembling hand to stroke one neck, then another and another. The floor seemed to firm up beneath her boots, and when she looked around, the world, this world, seemed to be stable. There was no blurriness at the edges of her vision, no sense that things were out of focus. The nausea began ebbing like a slow and reluctant tide. She looked around. There were no technicians visible, but her armor's thermal scans pinged seven of them hiding behind consoles and the threshold generator itself. And, over to her left, was a fresh corpse that the centipede was crouched over, feasting on the still warm flesh. Disgusted, the hunter turned away. It took three or four steps until she felt well enough to walk normally. The pack followed her, the older ones anticipating her and racing to the fire tower door to yip and snap at it. Now that she was fully in this world, the hunter gathered her strength and focused on the mission. There was a brass plate bolted to the machine, and she paused for a moment to read it. Gateway Initiative, Arnold Benjamin, PhD, Administrative Director. Abigail Corman, Project Director, for the benefit of all mankind. The words stung her. In each world she'd visited, there was a machine like this, often called Gateway, just as in her own world. In other worlds, it was known by other names. God Machine, Dera Aietas, Leifstenar, Orpheus Gate, Shiki, Longo, Port Rouge, Hellgate, Portao do Inferno. So many others, but in every single one of those worlds, there was an Abby Corman. Very often there was a Dr. Benjamin, too. Some of the other names and faces of the staff recurred, or sometimes it was Abby Corman and a group of total strangers. But over the last few years, the hunter had gotten closer and closer to this world, to the world where the ripple effect had begun. Here, this gateway, this Abby Corman, the hunter was sure of it. She hurried to the console and studied the control settings. In each world where a device like this was built, the orientation was either subtly or radically different. There had been a world where the machine was partly organic, another where it had been built underwater, so many variations. However, the design philosophy was the same because it had to be. That similarity made these machines sisters linked through the infinity of an omniverse, links in a chain that stretched through eternity. These controls were a different configuration than most she'd seen, but at the same time, there was a lot that the hunter felt was familiar. She stood for a moment, lightly touching keypads and dials and display screens.
"Will this be the world where I catch you?" she murmured. "Will this be the world where I kill you?"
She closed her eyes and prayed that it was so. She prayed to a god that never once answered her, a god who might not even exist. So many of her prayers seemed like echoes bouncing around forever in an empty building. The hunter opened the panel on the top of her left forearm and compared the numbers stored there with those on the console. They were close, but not precisely matched. Closer, though, than any world she could remember visiting. That similarity sent a thrill of excitement through her.
"Please, please," she begged. "Please let it be this world."
The pack picked up her anxiety and whined, their shrill cries sounding like frightened children. The hunter held out a hand to them, letting each one take her scent in pack order, from the dominant matriarch to the youngest males. They calmed down, but only a little. The hunter refocused on her task and began pressing keys on a terminal. She typed quickly, inputting the command override code, a long string of numbers, letters, and symbols. The fingers of the armored gloves were thin and flexible, allowing her the dexterity to do this, but even so, she went only as fast as care would allow. Every single one of the gateway machines had a similar kind of security lockout. One or two bungled attempts were acceptable, but the third, always the third, locked the system completely. And so the hunter was very careful. The hounds wandered away and scratched at the fire door that the mother of none had passed through. They all knew her scent. Of course they did. And they would all chase her until they caught her or died in the attempt, ignoring all other prey. Just as she would hunt that destructive witch all the way until her own last breath, or the death of Abby Corman. The hunter typed the last few characters, took a steadying breath, and pressed the enter key, and absolutely nothing happened. The system did not shut down the threshold. The system did not reject the code. The system, in fact, did not react at all. The console was already locked out. No, she breathed. She folded slowly at the waist, as if she'd been stabbed in the belly, bending until her helmeted forehead rested on the console. No, she said. Not again. The rage, always held under such iron control, boiled inside of her. She staggered back from the console, fists balled but held at her sides. The rage was so big, so black, that she wanted to smash things. Anything. But she dared not let that fury out, because if she damaged the console, or any part of the delicate gateway machinery, then the threshold would stay open and continue to cycle faster and faster until reality itself was torn apart. Forever, throughout the infinite worlds. So, the hunter wheeled around and screamed. It was a horrible sound, a cry of passionate hatred so terrible that it scalded her chest and ripped at the lining of her throat. She tasted blood in her mouth and felt tears in her eyes. Find the mother of none. Force the hated woman to give up the access codes to this world's gateway. Shut down the cycling effect of the threshold. Pry the worlds apart. And then restart the gateway clean and use it to wipe Abby Corman from all existence. Destroy her and erase all of her aspects from the uncountable versions of the dying planet Earth. Chapter 7. The Pierce Tower, the climb. David fired and fired. The creature swerved, and for a crazy moment, David thought that it understood what a gun was and the danger it represented, and that it was deliberately avoiding the shots. But no, the swerve was erratic, reactive, and as it passed out of the shadow of another skyscraper and into the cold moonlight, David saw that one side of its body was now painted in an oily black, the color of blood in a night-dark landscape. "You can bleed," he said aloud, more to give himself confidence than anything else. "God damn it, you can bleed." Bleeding or not, injured or not, the reptilian bird came at him again, driven by hunger, by bloodlust or rage, or maybe crazed by its own pain. The monster did not stop, did not pause. It reached for him with its talons, as if it would pluck him from the side of the building. He held the gun as steady as he could, but naked fear made his hands tremble. He fired and missed, fired again and missed. It was coming so fast, but the gun barrels seemed to be jerking all over the place. David took a breath and held it until the bird was too close to miss. He aimed for its chest and fired, forcing his hands to obey, squeezing rather than jerking the trigger, emptying the last rounds of the magazine into it. The creature had built up so much momentum that even as the slugs tore through scaly hide, flesh, and bone, it continued forward. With a cry, David flung himself to one side, running along the side of the skyscraper suspended by the rope. The bird thing slammed into the glass and seemed to explode into a mass of torn skin and blood. The piercing cry was instantly cut off as it died right there. David caught the cleft between a window and the wall and hung there, gun outstretched in one hand, the slide locked back, chest heaving. Watching as the bird thing slid down the curved side of the tower, leaving a red-black smear. It reached the outermost point of the curve and then fell straight down out of sight. For a long time, David stood there, suspended at a 45-degree angle from the building, buffeted by the wind, absolutely terrified, but not by the height or the risk of falling. Those were ordinary things, commonplace danger any climber accepts. No, that damn bird. He looked up where the thing had vanished and saw another shape briefly silhouetted against the moon, also bird-like, also malformed and strange, but much, much bigger. It was high in the sky, but when it opened its mouth to utter its hunting cry, the sound was massive, a shockwave of sonic force that exploded windows on the buildings across the street. There was a flare of bright light, like a match struck on the sky itself, and then something streaked across the stars toward the thing. It took David a moment to understand that a helicopter, invisible against the bottomless black of the night sky, had fired a rocket at the thing. The explosion, when it came, bloomed in shades of sunflower yellow and Halloween orange. The creature screamed again, but this time there were notes of panic and pain, and then it fell, trailing fire as it plummeted toward the street far below. David watched it fall. His mind did not want to call it a dragon, but there was no other word for it. From snout to tail, it had to be 60 feet long. The sheer physics of it being able to fly twisted his brain into painful shapes. The world had stopped making sense. "God almighty," he whispered. Then he came back to himself and patted his pockets to find another magazine. He swapped it for the empty one and put that in his pocket. He holstered the gun and looked around just in time to see a 10-story building lean outward as if weary. It was several blocks away, nowhere near where the giant bird had fallen. It fell in surreal, slow motion. All those thousands of tons of brick, steel, glass, and human flesh. The thing sprawled across the street and was immediately obscured in a swirling cloud of gray dust. Something moved within the giant cloud, a vast, dark form that stood on two legs but was larger than anything that had ever or could ever have walked the earth. It was like watching a Godzilla movie, except this was the real world, and whatever cast that shadow was there. Not a Hollywood special effect, not some distortion resulting from David's own injuries or trauma. Something beyond all rationality had just toppled a building, and he could hear its heavy, snuffling grunts echo through the skyscraper canyons. He forced himself to turn away, to focus on what he'd come here to do. "Abby," he said, holding on to her name as if it were a talisman. "I'm coming for you." He took hold of the rope and began to walk slowly back to where he'd been. David was aware that he was not in a useful frame of mind. He could feel the shock working its dark magic on him, twisting his reactions, releasing all the wrong chemicals into his brain. His hands shook badly as he pulled on the rope. Every step was more awkward and leaden than it should have been. At that moment, he doubted he could have walked normally across the stable floor. There was a part of him that wanted to just stop, not to climb down, but to cut himself free of the rope and fall. It was an old, old voice David had long ago tried to silence. It was the voice that whispered in the ear of the fat, awkward, nerdy kid he'd been when he was in middle school. The abused kid who had to sneak makeup from his stepmom's bathroom to hide the bruises from his father's fists. The kid who was told every day that he was a worthless piece of shit. That voice had been silent for 20 years. It had faltered when in 10th grade he joined the track team to try to run off the weight, and had. It had grown quieter still through the years of martial arts, boxing, fencing, wrestling, baseball, football, and hockey. There had been murmurs during rough patches, but only that. Echoes of the parasite his father's physical and verbal abuse had planted under his skin. That voice had vanished entirely when he joined the military and was utterly silent as he rose to become a special operator and decorated combat vet. By the time he was back in civilian life and building his Deep Core fitness brand, there were not even echoes of it. Now it whispered to him,
saying bad things. Telling him that he couldn't save Abby. Him? No way. He couldn't even get in the front door, and there was no way someone as weak and lame and frightened as